This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 30th of April 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, broadcasting live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up in the next hour, we'll be getting the latest in the race for the Lycée Palace. We'll chat with Monocle's French election contributor, Christine Ocrant, on the scandals and insults popping up on the campaign trail. China Eastern has just bought 20 Boeing 777s worth $6 billion, just as it posted a profit loss of 73%. We'll get analysis from Stephen Trimble of Flight Global. We'll also talk with Harold James, the author of a new book on Krupp, the famous German steel and arms maker. And Universal Pictures, the legendary Hollywood studio, is 100 years old today. We'll talk about the difference between the studios and their roles in an age of crowdfunding. All that, plus a chat with Monocle's senior editor Sophie Grove, and a song or two, right here on Midori House on Monocle 24. But first, I suggest we get the global news headlines from Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. 9 people, including Syrian military personnel, were killed and 100 were wounded in bomb blasts today near security service buildings in Idlib. Twin explosions, the latest to disrupt a shaky UN truce, blew fronts off nearby buildings and left craters in roads, according to images on state television, which showed people at the scene condemning the rebels who are fighting to oust President Bashar al-Assad. At least 30 people died today when a ferry carrying around 300 passengers capsized in a storm and heavy rain in a river in the northeastern Indian state of Assam. A dozen people were rescued after the ship capsized in the Brahmaputra River, but more than 200 people were still missing. The UN Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon has addressed Burma's parliament, welcoming its recent reforms, and urged Western powers to ease economic sanctions further. As the first foreign dignitary to address Burma's fledgling parliament, Ban welcomed the country's recent reforms.
I urge the international community to go even further in lifting, suspending, or easing trade restrictions and other sanctions.
Ban said he had no doubt that under the year-old civilian government, Burma would catch up with its Asian neighbours, but he warned of what he called perils and pitfalls on a difficult road ahead. The Chinese dissident Chen Guangcheng's escape from house arrest to US diplomatic protection was a miracle of planning and endurance, but the blind activist hopes to stay in China and campaign for reform, according to one of his key helpers. Chen's supporters say he's now under US diplomatic protection in Beijing. After escaping 19 months of stifling informal detention in his rural home, his future the subject of fraught secret talks between China and the United States. The European Commission President José Manuel Barroso will not visit Ukraine because of the treatment of imprisoned former Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko, adding to the number of European leaders boycotting the country. Ukraine is hosting a summit of Central European presidents in the Black Sea resort of Yalta on May the 11th, and the Euro 2012 soccer tournament, which it's co-hosting with Poland in June. It wasn't clear whether Barroso, head of the EU's executive, had been planning to attend either of those events. A Bahraini court has ordered a retrial for the jailed hunger striker Abdul Hadi al-Khawaja and 20 other men convicted of leading an uprising last year, but an opposition leader said the gesture was not enough to defuse resurgent unrest. Following international calls for meaningful democratic reforms and the release of jailed dissidents in Bahrain, a Manama court ruled that 21 protest leaders convicted in a closed-door military court should be retried in a civilian chamber. Today is the official start of campaigning in Egypt's first presidential election since the fall of the former incumbent in the office, Hosni Mubarak. But political manoeuvring among the poll's frontrunners has been underway now for several months. One of the potential favourite presidential candidates who's been driving up support is the former foreign minister, Amr Moussa.
I believe that Egypt has been injured and Egypt has been mismanaged, and Egypt should not get into an experiment that has not been tried before, and in order for us to enter into a period of confusion.
And the Australian mining and tourism billionaire Clive Palmer has announced plans to build a 21st century version of the Titanic with a Chinese state-owned company, more than 100 years after the original sank with loss of 1,500 lives. The luxury liner, described as every bit as luxurious as the original, is expected to make its maiden voyage from England to North America, the old Titanic route, late in 2016. Palmer said his new shipping company, Blue Star Line Property Limited, had signed a memorandum of understanding with the Chinese state-owned company CSC Yinling Shipyard to build the Titanic II.
We think it'll be a great achievement. It'll also be a great tribute to the people who designed the original Titanic. It was certainly their intention that their work and the skill and their endeavours survived into the future. And we think we've got a vested interest in ensuring that it survives into the next century.
And those are the Titanic top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Nick, for those. It's 18:05 here in London, and you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Music to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 target, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 is your cousin.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
On Sunday, the second round runoff for the French presidential election will be held. All signs point to an outcome that was seen as highly unlikely only months ago. With 53% of the forecasted vote, François Hollande is on track to beat his rival to secure his spot as the next leader of the Republic. But it's been one of the nastiest campaigns in recent memory, with insults flying on both sides. Monocle's regular French contributor, Christine Ocrant, is on the line now to give us an update on what all the accusations have been about. Christine, I wanted to ask you, first of all, is this pretty normal standard fare for a French presidential election?
Frankly, Andrew, no. I think it's really been awful. And I think it's about the worst campaign ever. The attacks are vicious. The atmosphere is very, very tense. Now, for the past 2 days, on each side has been digging, how could I put it, dirty linen. On one side, Dominique Strauss-Kahn made a reappearance, which is quite embarrassing for François Hollande. Strangely enough, he was invited to a sort of birthday party as a surprise guest. And all the socialist hierarchy, all the mandarins surrounding Hollande, who'd been also invited, just left when they saw him arrive, and Ségolène Royal being the first of them. And so Hollande had to say in a meeting in front of a very large crowd that Strauss-Kahn is, of course, totally ousted from French politics, and he has to answer the judges in tribunal. Okay, so that's for the left. Now, for Sarkozy, a website which, how could I put it, is not always very reliable, but very angry at Sarkozy and very antagonistic, pretends that they have a letter certifying that Gaddafi, when he was still in power, had offered lots of money for Sarkozy's election back in 2007. Now, it seems that one of the Libyans, supposed to have signed that letter, that guy says it's a fake, but Sarkozy is furious, of course, and is suing that website in court. So, you know, it really stinks. I mean, every day, three times a day, you have affairs like that, which contribute little, frankly, to democracy. I mean, it's just a pitiful scene to watch.
And Christine, could you tell me what lies at the root of this? Is it down to really deep-seated personal animosity between the two men?
Well, there are now only, 4 days left? And so it's not so much personal animosity. It's that Sarkozy wants to win, and so does Hollande. And so it's usually, you know, about politics. It's usually the entourage, people who think they can be smart and be useful and outdo what the next comrade is doing. But no, it's been a very nasty campaign, frankly. And ever since, the Sunday before last, the first round, it's been getting worse.
Now, I also want to pick up, there's another little story I saw over the weekend. There was this this row also about the language used by Mr. Sarkozy in a speech, where he's now been accused by someone on Hollande's team of using the language of Vichy France during the period of Nazi Germany. Obviously, this is a very kind of tough issue for French people. So on one hand, he's being accused of being a fascist collaborator. And I think this came about because he made a speech in which he said, Sarkozy unbelievably said, to be treated as a fascist by a communist is a compliment. Again, it seems this is kind of really kind of bitter old rivalries coming up, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. But you lucky British, you didn't have Vichy and you don't have a communist party. So it's actually the insult to Sarkozy was the headline of L'Humanité, which is the communist daily. And I think on the web, there was a sort of, one of these phony photos where Sarkozy had a sort of military cap similar to that of Marshal Pétain. These are just, dirty jokes. But it's true that the language is vilified, and it's of course much more acute on Sarkozy's side because although he's gone up one point, he's still trailing 47-53, and so I guess he and his people are getting more and more tense, and the language, of course, reflects that.
And also, Hollande, I understand, almost never refers to Sarkozy by name, or just literally avoids actually trying to have to say that word. Again, does this show that things are going to always be very difficult between these two men?
No, Hollande has been extremely careful about not only his language but his positions, trying to say as little as possible. He's mastered his campaign quite remarkably, and so he never says Sarkozy by name, but he says the outgoing president or the incumbent president or the president of unemployment or the president of failure to, and so on and so forth. It's not personal. It's just extremely bitter and violent politics.
And so do you think that Hollande is the one who's looking a little bit more presidential at this point because he's been less willing to get involved in the fights?
That's very true. And it was very striking on a TV program last week where they talked one after the other. And Sarkozy looked like the challenger and Hollande looked like the president, the man in charge of the nation, the consensus, and so on and so forth. In any case, the coming TV debate, traditionally in France, there's always one encounter face-to-face between the two remaining candidates. And that's going to happen this coming Wednesday. And that will be an extraordinary moment because these are two very talented men, very different in character and in experience, but very gifted indeed. And you know how much the French love words, so it will be a sort of contest in words.
And just moving off this kind of this personal battle, can I just ask you, in the last days, there doesn't seem to be a huge movement in the polls, maybe 1% more for Sarkozy in the last couple of days. Do you think there's any chance of Sarkozy turning this around?
Frankly, I very much doubt it. Anything can happen in politics. Anything can happen, in the coming 5 days. But Sarkozy has really been so crude in his efforts to win back the extreme right voters. He has been so aggressive against, you know, trade unions, the elites, name it, that again, it gained him a point, that's for sure. But they are a bit more than three to go, and I think that's very hard indeed.
Well, Christine, thank you very much for joining us. That was Christine Ocrant, who's our French election contributor. You're listening to Midori House. We're about to enjoy some music from Raphael Sadiq, so stay with us.
On the latest edition of The Menu with me, Markus Hippi, we grab our library card and visit Chicago to get a lesson in growing your own food. We also head to Istanbul in search of the best Turkish coffee, and we find out about the art of fine dining. That's a plethora of foodie stories for you.
He said that it's the most beautiful, delicious, sweet tomato that he's ever grown.
Of course, we will find out what's in Santiago's basket. We'll get a great dinner soundtrack recommendation, and as always, much, much more on the latest episode of The Menu.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug. If you're on the go but still want to stay tuned in to Monocle 24, then download the Monocle mobile phone app. You'll have access to our live stream, past shows, Monocle's daily web column, and our 2525 city guides. And it's available for iPhone, Windows Phone 7, and Nokia N9 devices. So take Monocle 24 with you wherever you are, whether you're beachside or airborne. Head to monocle.com for more details.
And this is Monocle 24 and Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. Time for some music now, and this is Raphael Sadiq with Sometimes.
Let me tell you about my day. It's such a very long day. Oh, oh, sometimes
that was Sometimes by Raphael Sadiq, and you're listening to Monocle 24. Earlier today, the Shanghai-based airline China Eastern announced that it agreed to purchase 20 Boeing 777s, an order worth about $5.94 billion at US list prices. They explained that the purchase will help them satisfy the increasing demand on international long-haul routes. But the move comes as the company posted a hefty profit loss of 73% in the first quarter of this year. For his analysis, we're joined now on the line by Stephen Trimble, America's managing editor at aviation specialist Flight Global. Stephen, thank you for joining us. First of all, could there's two obviously conflicting stories going on here. Why have they suffered such a kind of fall in profits?
Well, it's not China Eastern's. It's a problem that's not limited to China Eastern. The fuel bills for all airlines around the world have gone up considerably in the first quarter this year. And I'm sure there are probably a few other things involved in China Eastern's situation, but that accounts for most of it.
And the order for these 20 Boeings, how significant of an order is that?
Well, and it's actually complementary to the issue of the fuel price. You're talking about bringing in new aircraft that are more fuel efficient, that have two engines versus four engines to do the same route. The intention there is to help them reduce their fuel bill in the future.
Now,
I'm sorry, what was your question again?
I was just asking that how significant it was as an order for an airline like China Eastern.
This is very significant. 20 orders for 20 777s don't come around very often. That's a lot of money and a lot of aircraft for a single airline. And it allows them to get rid of their A340s. that they have. They have about six of them. And then increase their fleet to meet the demand that they see increasing from Shanghai.
And can you just give us some kind of idea where China Eastern sits in the kind of the great range of international airlines and Chinese airlines as well? Is it the biggest player in China?
No, but I mean they're growing. They're in the top four airlines in China, and they are growing like all of them are. The Chinese carriers are expected to grow faster than any other airlines around the world.
And where does that growth come from? Is it nearly all domestic travelers looking to fly long haul?
That's correct. It's supposed to be the growth will be driven by domestic growth, domestic demand, and as well as some international growth as well.
Now, a few years ago, we saw the explosion of airlines that happened in India after deregulation there. And you saw so many players coming into the market, you know, huge orders for planes. And then that market went very badly wrong. We're seeing similar signs of kind of huge orders here in China, airlines struggling with debt. Do you think there's a risk that there will be a kind of a shakeout for the Chinese aviation industry in the coming years?
Yeah, it hasn't gotten as disproportionate, or I guess as crazy as it got in India. There may be a bubble of some kind growing in China, but it's not on the scale of the Indian bubble that we saw. And you also for the Chinese airlines, there haven't been the kind of startups like we saw in India in 2006 and 2007.
And just tell me, the China Eastern, does it have an opportunity to kind of take away kind of passengers from other hubs, you know, for example, the kind of people who'd be flying through Dubai these days? Or is it really only Chinese people who want to fly on these airlines? Are they finding it tough to kind of persuade people when they get on their plane in London to, for example, jump on a China Eastern plane?
It's more specific. Yeah, the Dubai the Emirates model, the Qatar Airways model, the idea there is to be the intermediate stop between Asia and Europe, or Asia and the U.S., whereas Shanghai doesn't really fill that spot. That's more of just a destination. So it wouldn't be in the same category as what we've seen in the Middle East.
And again, when you look at what the flight offering from China Eastern, when you look at the rankings of the world's best airlines on anything from service, obviously leading on service, really, do you see China Eastern up there? Do you see any of the Chinese airlines becoming real global kind of benchmark players?
In some ways, they already are, and they are driving not quite as much as. Singapore or Middle East, but they are definitely driving demand and innovation and cabin improvements, and certainly the manufacturers have taken notice.
Well, Stephen Trimble from Flight Global, thanks so much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House, and it's time now for some more music. This is Lana Del Rey and Radio.
Not even they can stop me now. Dream on living, baby, love me cause I'm playing on the radio. Pick me up and take me like a vitamin, cause my body's sweet like sugar from the moyet.
And that was Lana Del Rey with Radio. In the next half hour on Midori House, we'll be looking at the world of foreign affairs, the history of Krupp, and the role of the modern film studio. But first, here's Nick Kelly with the news headlines.
Thanks, Andrew. Nine people, including Syrian military personnel, were killed and 100 wounded in bomb blasts today near security service buildings in Idlib. At least 30 people died when a ferry carrying around 300 passengers capsized in a storm and heavy rain in a river in the northeastern Indian state of Assam. The UN Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon has addressed Burma's parliament, welcoming its recent reforms and urged Western powers to ease economic sanctions further. The Chinese dissident Chen Guangcheng's escape from house arrest to US diplomatic protection was a miracle of planning and endurance, but the blind activist hopes to stay in China and campaign for reform. That's according to one of his advisors. European Commission President José Manuel Barroso will not visit Ukraine because of the treatment of imprisoned former Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko, adding to the number of European leaders boycotting the country. A Bahraini court has ordered a retrial for jailed hunger striker Abdulhadi al-Khawaja and 20 other men convicted of leading an uprising last year, but an opposition leader said the gesture was not enough to defuse resurgent unrest. Spain sank into recession in the first quarter, and economists said spending cuts aimed at meeting strict EU deficit limits, together with the reeling banking sector, would delay any return to growth until late this year or beyond. And the Australian mining and tourism billionaire Clive Palmer has announced plans to build a 21st century version of the Titanic with a Chinese state-owned company, more than 100 years after the original sank, with the loss of 1,500 lives. Those are the top stories on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Nick. Now it's time to find out what stories have caught the eye of Monocle's editors. Today we're joined by senior editor Sophie Grove to chat about the world of global affairs. That's a small thing to chat about.
I know.
the world is literally yours. Well, not literally. The world is yours for the next few minutes.
Well, I've had a look at some of the things that are sort of coming up this week. One of which is sort of actually sort of ground Europe to a shuddering halt in many ways. The ECB, European Central Bank meeting in Barcelona, usually takes place in Frankfurt, but 17 of heads of European banks from around the Eurozone area are convening in sunny Barcelona. And there's been a lockdown, really. Spain has cancelled or suspended Schengen, which is the visa-free sort of way of travelling that, makes Europe so easy to move around, because they are really worried about violent protests in Barcelona. I mean, we just heard in the news there from Nick that there's a crisis of huge proportions in the Spanish economy. 50% of young people are out of work.
So effectively, does this mean that anybody entering Spain, the Spanish immigration officials can check who you are, and if you look like the kind of person who might kind of throw a tomato, they can haul you out of the queue?
Exactly. I mean, what they don't want is all these people going, convening from around Europe and heading there to cause a massive stink. And they're doing lots of things. I mean, the Interior Ministry has set up this name and shame website, so they can take closed circuit television snapshots of protesters and then put them out, to kind of shame them into not wanting to do this stuff. And then there's also, closing the borders isn't really going to do anything, because there are so many disgruntled young people in Spain. They're called the Indignados, the Indignant Movement of Youths. And basically, they're going to be there in force, and they know that. So the police have bolstered their efforts and I think there's 2,000 extra police deployed in Barcelona. So, I mean, they're really bracing themselves on Thursday.
Spain's got quite a good navy. They should have met on a frigate or something. Then they could have, It's very hard to kind of hit a moving frigate with a tomato.
I know. I think tomatoes are the least of their worries, Andrew.
But I think they've got a lot of tomatoes in Spain. So I was just thinking missiles that might be ready to hand if you went down to the kind of the market. Anyway, the next story, are we going to have Clinton next?
We are. Clinton, Secretary Clinton, is
Clinton
off.
To me, we're pals.
Just Hills.
Hills.
Hills. She's off, we think, to Beijing this evening. She was scheduled to go from Washington to China this evening. And because there's been a diplomatic skirmish of sorts with the dissident lawyer, the blind activist Chen Guangcheng, who is said to be in the American embassy in Beijing. So what happened is that the US have sent their top diplomat out there to try and, pave the way and sort of feather this diplomatic crisis. Kurt N. Campbell is there. I mean, the US are being very, very low-key about this. They haven't done any press, but he was photographed in the Marriott. So we think he's there and he's sort of trying to kind of get everything ready for when Clinton arrives, because, you know, actually there's a really great article in the New York Times today about this, and they've quoted somebody, Christopher Johnson, who is a China analyst from the CIA, saying this is the greatest test in bilateral relations in years, probably going back to 1989.
I was intrigued because I think actually the last time somebody kind of fled the US embassy, who was a Chinese dissident, was some years ago, but it took a year to negotiate for them to be able to leave the country. So it looks like it could be a long haul at a very sensitive time for diplomatic relations between the two countries.
Exactly. And, you know, it's so difficult for them because, you know, we were just seeing from White House analysts last week that they're thinking that China's moving their foreign policy towards this sort of more altruistic stance on Iran, on Sudan. They think that they're going to be cooperating with the UN much more. And then suddenly, one person like this, as we know with the Litvinenko scandal here, I mean, it just completely put the absolute kibosh on any of the bilateral relations between countries.
The Americans obviously aren't talking about it, but you wonder when somebody turns up at the US embassy, they must have known who he was. It must have been slightly prearranged. Otherwise, I presume it's quite complicated just to kind of barge your way into the embassy.
And we know that with the Bo Chilai whistleblower, he sought refuge at the US embassy and was turned away. So, I mean, it really is quite unprecedented that he's there under US custody. And then also, you know, Romney is calling for him to be, airlifted out of there, along with his family. You know, and it's becoming a really interesting political debate within the US too, at a really critical time.
I wonder what the rules are about what you can put in a diplomatic bag.
I know. Maybe a blind activist.
Yes.
We'll see how that works. And I mean, Clinton is going to have to do some serious diplomacy.
Okay, they're laughing at me on the other side of the glass. You might be able to put someone in a diplomatic pouch. I don't know. You can certainly get a spy in a bag. Why not a kind of a rebel in a pouch?
Andrew
Tuck. Who knows? Anyway, next story.
Japan's PM, Prime Minister, Yoshinko Noda, is in the US. He arrived on Sunday. And that it's an interesting time for them because they're looking, you know, we're seeing this sort of recalibration of US policy moving towards Asia. They're setting up, you know, we've done so much on it here at Monocle, looking at setting up a base in Darwin. But then, you know, this is being reflected in their relationship with Japan, and apparently the talks have been about, you know, establishing a joint base in Guam or the nearby islands in northern Mariana Islands, or you know, this military alliance, which is quite a new thing, especially for neutral Japan, and it shows the way that their military is changing from being completely domestically focused to looking beyond their borders. And apparently they've also been talking about the rocket launch on the 13th of April in North Korea, which has, you know, really sort of made everybody sort of sit up and think, right, this is happening right on Japan's doorstep and they need to get the US on board.
Because we've covered so many stories about the kind of standoff in the sea of the China Seas between everyone from the Philippines, Vietnam, kind of fighting over every little kind of rock and atoll and boulder that kind of perks its little nose up above the waterline. And the difficulty, obviously, is that Japan's kind of restrictions on its military and on its navy following the Second World War are still kind of in place. So they're very dependent, aren't they, on the US kind of stepping forward and aiding them in some ways?
They are. I mean, in a sense, they've just had this lockdown for so many years that their military force isn't really ready for any sort of aggressive situation. So they're looked after by the US. There are 9,000 Marines in bases in around Japan, and this weekend they've been talking about moving those Marines out, which is another significant move, in re-establishing their independence as a military force.
And you have one final piece for us, which is about the world of horses.
It is. It's a shocking story, and it's a big, big report that the New York Times has just released today about horse racing in Queens, the Aqueduct racetrack. It's there's about 7 or 8 different journalists working on this one story, so you can just see it's one of the New York Times really going for it. But it's about horses that have just been really abused. The casino was established, a kind of Las Vegas style casino was established 3 years ago at this racetrack. And since then, the amount of horses that have had to be euthanized and killed during races has just shot up. So there's been a jockey boycott of certain horses that are owned by some guys, mainly this guy called Rick Gill, who just seems like, there were 10 of his horses died in 9 months on the track. There's absolutely terrible investigation by the Fed has actually shown that they were injecting horses with all sorts of drugs before, sort of painkillers, and having horse thoroughbreds run with arthritis, and it just shows you it's kind of an escalation of this culture of gambling. The prize just escalated more and more, and these horses have just been the victim of that. But it looks like they've got to the bottom of it, and these exposés really do help with that type of thing.
Oh God, I feel like crying now.
I know. Well, when you've read it, I mean, I've printed it out, the story out here, and it's a wodge of incredibly moving stories if you love horses, and which I do. And also, I was speaking to our New York editor Aisha, and she said it really is a reflection of how interested people are in horses because of this great HBO series Luck. Suddenly, people have started thinking about the gambling world and the racing world, and that's actually turned some of the journalistic kind of might onto this area that's kind of, an underdog. People aren't taking much notice of it.
And what's great is, that's what the New York Times is good at, that it will put 7 journalists on a story like that, and it will bring you a kind of investigation that, that here on the other side of the world, we're talking about what's going on in Queens, and it's delivered it in a way that's, full of colour and vigour, and, makes you... It makes you realise why we still need old-fashioned media outlets. Well, Sophie Grove, thank you very much indeed for that. That was Sophie Grove, who's a senior editor here at Monocle. We're going to be back with lots more things right after this.
From São Paulo to Sapporo, from Brooklyn to Buenos Aires, with a samba, bossa, jazz, poppier, rock and roller, frankly far superior station, to discover the newest and finest sounds. This... She makes me want to dance. It's the sound of Monocle spinning its musical globe. Check in with our editors turned DJs as they whisk you through the time zones as we take you continental, Atlantic and Pacific. Round the clock, round the block, music on Monocle 24.
Nestled into the urban fabric of London, Hong Kong, New York and Tokyo, Monocle shops are small, cosy outposts of everything we care about. That's incredible design, credible provenance, charming service, and of course, intelligent journalism. Stock up on the latest issue of the magazine, browse our carefully curated selection of books and music, or seek out your favourite back issue to fill that gap in your Monocle archive. So, drop in to one of our shops, and our friendly staff will be on hand to show you around. For addresses and opening hours, visit monocle.com.
The German steel giant Krupp has come to represent the best and the worst of the nation's industrial history. It's a source of inventiveness and also shame because of its involvement with the Nazi regime. Now, a new authorised history attempts to offer a balanced picture of the family that founded it and the events that shaped its history. Author Harold James joins us on the line now. Harold, I wanted to ask you, first of all, this is an authorised book. Was Krupp interested in finding a way of telling a story, in a more nuanced way?
Well, I think it's a kind of remarkable story in that this is a very, very characteristic German company, but it's been around for a long time. And it's also just an iconic name, and so, particularly in the United States, the name of Krupp is very much associated with a famous book, now several decades old, by William Manchester, On the Arms of Krupp, that gives a kind of lurid and actually wrong picture of the company's history.
But they were interested in then in presenting a kind of not, you know, not a cleaned up image, but a less lurid image.
Yes, I mean, sure. This is this is an attempt to put the history of the company in the perspective of 200 years worth of German history.
And now, just take you back to the very beginnings of Krupp. How did it become such a powerful player in Germany?
It's odd in that the company is known for basically all of its history as the company of Friedrich Krupp, and so the founder of it was a man called Friedrich Krupp, who inherited this firm from his mother. But essentially, he never made any profits, and the company was really ground into the dust, and it was revived by his son. But his son always wanted to keep the name of Friedrich Krupp, I think as a reminder of those very, very difficult early years.
And it started off as a steel maker, did it?
What it did was that it made a particular kind of machinery, so very, very specialized products that were very hard steel, used for stamping coins at the mints at the time, and in particular then for the Prussian mint. So it wasn't mass steel at all at the beginning. It was a very, very precise, high-quality steel for tools.
And then the history of when the company does get dragged into being one of the key players in Nazi Germany, it was very interesting reading the kind of chapters on that because, again, you're right, you do present a kind of a less lurid image. It was interesting that actually so many Jewish people had been important in the company right up until the late 30s. And that, in fact, the Krupp family, some of them had done quite a lot to kind of try and protect those people, and they weren't that keen on being being sucked into the kind of the Nazi way of doing business.
Well, one of the famous stories about Krupp is that he was the owner of the firm, Gustav Krupp von Bohlen and Halbach, was the head of the German business interest group, the equivalent of the CBI, in the early 1930s. And so he played a big role in industrial politics, but he, unlike some of the other German big steel makers, didn't like the idea of bringing Hitler into government in 1932 and was really very distant from those attempts in 1932. Then in 1933, when Hitler is actually there, there's a rather fraught relationship because the thing that Hitler was most interested in at the beginning was extracting money from these businessmen in order to finance, first of all, the election campaign for the parliament, and then the activities of the Nazi Party.
And before we move on to a kind of a different period, but what's interesting is that it did get very involved in the machinery of war, didn't it? Because many of the steel plants that were taken by the Nazis, for example, in Russia, were given to Krupp. There were there was forced labourers made to work in Krupp's factory in Essen, for example. So it did in the end become part of the kind of the Nazi war machine.
Oh, absolutely. That's very much the story of Krupp in the first half of the 20th century. So it became already in Imperial Germany this enormous arms manufacturer, and it was the really dominant arms manufacturer in Imperial Germany. And it had a big problem as a result in the peacetime years in the Weimar Republic, because Germany was demilitarized under the terms of the Versailles Treaty. And so in a sense, when they get back to producing for the army in the 1930s and for the navy, that's a great relief, and they're back to their mission from the early 20th century.
Now, after the war, Alfred Krupp was sent to jail. The company was broken up and divided into many different parts. But suddenly, there is this. You know, Alfred Krupp is released from jail, and there is an attempt to bring the company back together. It's a miracle that happened in a way, and is it intriguing that they decided to keep the name to continue trading as Krupp?
Yes, I mean that is perplexing and interesting. why did they do it? I think in part they were committed to the idea of a local enterprise in the Ruhr, and Krupp was very, very heavily identified with the city of Essen. And the population in Essen liked Krupp, and they liked this rather patriarchal attitude that Krupp had had in the 19th century and the provision of company houses. So there's part of an Essen patriotism involved in re-establishing the company. But also, it's very important, I think, as a name outside Europe. And in some of the markets that Krupp developed in the 50s and 60s in Brazil and China, Krupp was very much associated with armaments, but actually positively. And it's fascinating looking at these records from the 60s when the Krupp executives go and meet the Chinese communists, and Chu Enlai talks about the historic artillery pieces from the 19th century and the early 20th century. And that's for him the image of Krupp. And I think Krupp did build on that image to build then steel plants. I mean, it wasn't any more really engaged in military production, but it was in steel equipment.
And finally, can you just tell me, obviously in the post-war period, there's this amazing kind of opening up of the way that the company is run, and it becomes kind of an exemplary company in a way. It's openness, it's transparency, it's willingness to do things right. Is that a part of the DNA that you think runs through the brand and the company to this day?
Well, it is interesting. It's innovative in many ways. I mean, what it does in essence is actually to take over some of the American ways of thinking about company organization in the years after big and influential founders have departed. So it models itself, I think, very explicitly on the Ford Foundation, in that if you have a company that's owned by a foundation, it protects it in some ways. It protects it, for instance, from hostile takeovers. And there was a lot of talk in the 1960s and 1970s about rationalizing the steel industry, both in Germany and in Europe. And having a company owned by a foundation actually keeps it out of those kind of discussions. So, yes, it's interesting. It's innovative. I think it's a different kind of approach to business history than most businesses had in the, particularly in Britain or in the United States, where takeovers are much more common.
Well, Harold James, thank you so much for joining us. That's Harold James, whose new book is called Krupp, A History of the Legendary German Firm, and it's out now. And this is Midori House, and we're going to be back with a bit more news about the world of cinema just after this.
This is Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 tagat, ja.
Monocle 24 e jokasa.
This is Monocle 24.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Bropa Jalavet. Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
The iconic Universal Studios is marking its 100th birthday today. Home of classic films such as Jaws, Out of Africa and To Kill a Mockingbird, it's planning to celebrate its centenary by restoring and re-releasing some of its best-known titles. But in this age of crowdfunding, does the brand of a studio really matter anymore? We have Karen Krasanovich, film critic on the line, to discuss the role of Universal and also what the future holds for cinema studios in general. Karen, I just want to ask you, that's the kind of, I guess, the nub of it. Do people really care whether a film is made by Universal or by any of the other studios these days?
I don't think most people care, no. Outside of when you sit down and you watch the logo, for example, does it have a lion or does it have a world or does it have the Fox logo? You know, I don't think most people really care. Actually, in the old days, very, very old days in the inception of cinema, the studios had very different flavors. They would make very different films. Sometimes some would make drama, some would make comedy. So in the old days, it mattered. Now, of course, they are mainly, like, and NBC owns Universal, right now. So that they really just become part of a bigger sort of umbrella media organization.
And the big players these days, as you're saying, most of them actually do, they're not independent anymore. They belong to kind of big media organisations and media players. And you hinted there in the old days there used to be any difference. Do you think there's any real difference in the way that any of them are run these days?
I think when we're talking filmmaking, yes, I think that's right. I think that studios like Fox have a different attitude to Warner Brothers, have a different attitude to Universal. It's the way they produce their films. It's the way they decide to finance them. It's the kind of material that they look at. A lot of times scripts will be shopped from place to place to place, but generally the script will be changed. So fundamentally there are some philosophical and artistic choices made, yes.
And in the old days, obviously, studios were particularly associated with, you know, groups of actors or directors. You know, you would know that somebody belonged to a studio. Those days are long gone. But do you think we still see long-term relationships between directors and studios which are particularly fruitful? Or are most directors these days kind of happy to hawk their kind of films to whoever's going to pay them the most?
Well, a lot of, for example, Woody Allen and other directors have had long standing agreements with their studios and with the people that are producing them. I think these days, depending on how the artist, and I'm talking about a filmmaker as an artist, although it is a collaborative effort, obviously, I think how they're treated, how they feel they're listened to is very, very important. And I think right now, for example, you see a change in attitude by Fox. For example, there was an article that they're deciding to go more for the filmmaker's viewpoint rather than going for financial, purely financial products, which sounds a bit crass, but there's a subtle difference there. So, I mean, there are a lot of Universal moments. I mean, they're very proud of saying this because it is actually today is Universal's birthday. It started in 1912. And there are great Universal moments. For example, Elliot riding E.T. the extraterrestrial on his bike. Bruce, you know, you're going to need a bigger boat, Jaws. You know, Bruce is the shark. Back to the Future, Gladiator. All of these are Universal pictures.
And I wonder whether in these days, you know, for Disney and for Universal, it's the fairground. It's that side of it which actually reinforces their brand more than anything else. Going to Universal Studios, go on the rides, it's actually probably better kind of a brand reinforcement than actually many of their films.
Well, it could refresh it, certainly. I mean, if you've got Warner Brothers with Leavesden, with the Harry Potter world, Harry Potterville. So yeah, I mean, that's another way of extending the brand, of getting into a different market, refreshing the market. But I also think that that there is a tang for people. For example, what's really important is the value of the libraries. And Universal has a fantastic library. And I think that that's very important as well. So nobody can afford to really just have the brand do one thing. It has to be, has to move into new markets and refresh itself in people's memories.
Well, Karen Krasanovich, thank you so much for joining us. Karen has been a good kind of commenter on all things film for us for the last few months. So thank you very much for coming on today to talk about the role of Universal Studios. Well, I guess that's all for this edition of Midori House. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Toby Hammond. At 2200 London time, that's in 3 hours, Andrew Mueller and Emma Nelson will be back with the Monocle Daily. Tonight, they'll be talking about the hunt for Joseph Kony, and they'll chat with Monocle's acting edits section editor, Santiago Tarditi, live from the World's 50 Best Restaurants Award. But from me, goodbye.